Hi, I'm Sam Cedar.
And I'm Emma Vigeland. This week on Ring of Fire, Olufemi Taiwo, assistant professor of philosophy at Georgetown University, and Abigail Higgins, a journalist covering inequality, health, and gender, join me to discuss their piece in The Nation, How the Violence Against Women Act Failed Women.
And Heather Digby Parton will help me run down the biggest stories of the week. Become a member of this podcast over at ROFpodcast.com. It's your support that keeps this show going. And we're telling you, we're going to start putting stuff behind extra bonus material now for members going forward starting next week. So check that out. Head over to ROFpodcast.com to get extra bonus material for you each week. Here to break down this week's news, Heather Digby Parton from Salon and the popular blog Hullabaloo. So, Heather, a surprisingly, I think, a busy week this week. I mean, obviously, you know, there is there's the sort of ever-present COVID news, and there seems to be, we haven't quite plateaued. Some areas of the country are increasing in their infection rate, but nothing that it seems to be completely out of hand. And the pace of the vaccinations have gone up. There's some questions about the AstraZeneca vaccine, but I have a feeling those will be resolved soon. But on the political side, we have some legislative things to discuss. But then let's just start with what you wrote about this week, which has been the immigration. Now, there is clearly a humanitarian, if people want to call it crisis, I think that's fair, in terms of our inability as a country and our government's inability to properly absorb and to provide for the care of thousands of immigrant children. And that is a, I think, like an operational question as much as it is a policy question, and probably in many respects more so. We need to deal with this. But there has been this whole other narrative that has created this narrative as if it was like a caravan style crisis. I mean, I've said this many times this week, but I keep remembering when in the run up to the 2018 election, we were told there was this massive caravan that was so terrifying that people in Minnesota were afraid that their lake houses, their second houses, their lake houses were going to be taken over by this caravan. There's sort of something reminiscent about that now, isn't there?
Of course it is. And, you know, look, we can, you can, the political opportunism around this border crisis is just so plain and so obvious that I'm surprised that the mainstream media fell for it as quickly and as eagerly as they did. Even for them, I think this was a bit much, that they would just completely fall into that same, the grooves of those same old storylines and narratives that, you know, were clearly manufactured by the right wing. It's not to say there aren't a bunch of people at the border, but there have been a bunch of people at the border at this time of year for decades. I mean, this is something that happens, and for various reasons, sometimes there's more, sometimes there's less. And when you go back and look at the statistics, there was a great piece in the Washington Post this week, as opposed to a really terrible piece in the Washington Post this week, which was claiming there was a huge emergency and it was a crisis and, oh my God, what are we going to do? They went and looked, they did the analysis, the monkey cage, which is a, you know, an analytical page that they'd go and look at, they crunch numbers. They went and looked, and, you know, this is way, way down from where it was in the early 2000s. The numbers of immigrants and unaccompanied minors, although it's a record this year for the last 10 years, this is not unusual. I guess my point is that, you know, this happened during the Trump administration. 2019 was the worst year in 12 years, 2019. And they're trying to say, well, it's Biden's policies because he's welcoming people and he's saying he's a nice guy and he's kind and generous and decent. So they're all coming here hoping. Well, nobody came here in 2019 because they thought Donald Trump was kind and generous and decent. That makes no sense whatsoever. They come because of external factors, where they live, whatever the weather is. There are many reasons for doing it. Economic. There was a huge natural disaster in Central America, a major hurricane that blew up the whole country. And there's a bunch of people coming up for that reason. Also, COVID is now kind of starting to look like it, you know, maybe there's some light at the end of the tunnel, or we're, what did Trump used to say, rounding the curve or whatever. But, you know, so that has an effect on this, too. But the fact is that this is really not a gigantic crisis, unprecedented crisis. It is not caused by the Biden administration. And in fact, according to a report this week from NBC, I think, that said that the transition team, the Biden transition team, had been begging the Trump administration, hey, you got to build out, you got to open up these other facilities. There's a bunch of people coming at the border. This had been happening for months before Trump left, and they didn't do anything. The Trump HHS, run by Alex Azar, just, you know, shrugged his shoulders. And it wasn't until like the very last week or something that they even started contemplating opening up, I mean, the shelters, so that they don't have to stay in these border patrol facilities. And so this whole thing has just been manufactured by the right wing, which has been pumping this for the last month. They have just been going, which was expected. And the mainstream media, of course, jumped on it and started doing the whole gotcha thing. And, you know, look, well, what are you going to do about it? And don't you own the problem? And blah, blah, blah. So that's where we're at now. And it's just, you have to keep this in perspective. My piece was just saying, look, you have to report the story, but you do not have to engage in histrionics and theatrical sort of stunts, like going down to the border and putting your panel in front of the wall and that sort of thing. You don't have to do that. But, you know, of course, it was irresistible, I guess.
Well, I mean, that's what I mean. Like I said, there's two separate issues here. One is actually, and all of the things that you said, I had the opportunity to talk to a bunch of immigration reporters this week on the first hour of the Majority Report. And aside from all of the structural things, we have destabilized these countries. Their climate change is probably driving some of this. It is seasonal. There's also the question of Title 42, which is a very dubious rule, if you will, that the Trump administration started to basically prevent immigrants and asylum seekers in particular from coming into the country because of COVID. People are crossing the border all the time legally. They're not getting tested, not getting temperatures. All of the people who come in through immigration, they all get tested. So, in fact, their testing rate is lower than it is in Texas. So you welcome these people in, and your COVID infection rate goes down as a percentage. But the Biden administration, I think some surmise as a way of sort of like trying to even out who comes in, rescinded Title 42 for children, and many people sent their kids across the border. There is just not the capacity. People can argue that the Biden administration should have immediately on day one anticipated this and been able to build out this capacity. But there's clearly an attempt to do it. But it is, and we have a failure of a system that deals with this. I mean, bottom line. And we need to go down and address the root problems. These are things that can't happen overnight. But the idea, the histrionics and the politicization of what is fundamentally a bureaucratic problem, at least in this moment. I mean, there's policy changes that need to happen, but this is really about a transition coming in and not maybe being as efficient as they should be in terms of providing the sort of the stage two of processing children and any asylum seekers, which is get them out of the DHS silo and get them into the HHS, Health and Human Services and Refugee Service silo. And you and I have been observing the press this is their old trick. The idea that nobody went down to the border or had immigration crisis, you know, weekend shows during the Trump administration is bizarre. And it's even more bizarre that they decide to do this now. There is a desperation to both sides this and make it seem like they're being reasonable and moderate, and this is really very much a manufactured crisis. When we have, you know, some pretty big crises around the country right now, we're recording this Thursday night. It was Joe Biden's first press conference where there was an attempt to make this like some type of national crisis, that he hadn't had a press conference, even though they've answered questions. And as far as I know, he didn't get a single question about COVID. And it's stunning.
Well, it is stunning, and it's funny. On Twitter, I think it was Maggie Haberman of the New York Times, Cheryl Gay Stolberg, who said, "So the first questions are about immigration and the filibuster, none about COVID. I guess that shows where COVID is no longer a number one issue." And I tweeted back, you know, so who makes that decision? Because the press just, you know, they weren't interested in it. They're done with it. I guess it's boring. And, you know, they feel like we're rounding the curve or whatever the hell Trump used to say. And so they're not interested. And what they are interested in is the immigration provides this very excellent opportunity for them to do this kind of both sidesing and to, you know, reassert the idea that they are unbiased and their credibility isn't online, because they were very critical of Trump. I mean, that's the truth. Rightfully so. Trump was a disaster in every way. But they have this reflexive sort of need to even the score. And so what you're finding, immigration provided this particular issue provided this for them. The idea to say, hey, look, maybe Donald Trump had it right. Now, you know, Biden said in his press conference on Thursday that he, you know, they asked him about, you know, do you think it was right for you to say that, you know, welcome these people in, and should you have changed the rules, and should you be allowing the unaccompanied minors in, which they had kept out under the COVID regulations? And he said, well, you're asking me if I should have left a bunch of kids on the street in Mexico, and whether or not I should have, you know, let them just, you know, suffer. And no, I will never do that. I will never leave kids in the street. And by the way, and he pointed this out, and I thought it was very clever, neither did any other president until Donald Trump. He's the first one that thought it was okay to do that. So, you know, I feel like that sort of thing, this idea of trying to compare him, you know, it's leading to a sort of a validation of Trump's cruel policy, is what I see happening. It's saying, look, maybe he had it right. Maybe we shouldn't let all these kids in. Maybe we should separate families. You know, you can kind of see that happening. And I thought Biden handled that well, because he said, look, you know, what you're asking me to do is to leave people in squalid, you know, refugee camps.
And we should also say, like, there are many stories of, you know, these are children who more often than not have relatives in the United States. And to be clear, there are people, you know, who are trying to make money by kidnapping these kids and then essentially trying to ransom them for families in the United States. And this is. And good for Biden for defending that on sheer humanity grounds. But it's interesting, because this is the dynamic. The press seems to be trying to do this, and I don't know. It doesn't feel like it has gotten the traction that the effort that has been expended to, like, it doesn't seem to be catching fire. In part because it turns out maybe people are more concerned about COVID. Maybe people are more concerned about, we just had our first week in 52 or plus maybe, where we had a drop in the number of unemployed below 700,000, just barely. Still above where we were in the Great Recession, but nevertheless in the right direction anyways. These things may be more pertinent, but what is also fascinating, And of course, the issue of guns has come up. And I want to talk about the issue of gun control and the filibuster, although I think that's sort of secondary. It's certainly second order. But gun control and what we're hearing about infrastructure, and about you know, about this type of and S1, which is the Senate version of HR1. All of these things, I think, are giving us a picture of what we might be able to expect over the next couple of years. Really, next year and a half, really, I guess. And that is, it feels like there is a determination, and I don't want to overstate this because I certainly don't want to get anybody's hopes up, and certainly not mine, a determination by the Biden administration to go big in terms of spending, in terms of, like, I don't want to say fundamentally, but pretty close, at least within the context of our sort of capitalist system as it is, to do a reset button and to break sort of some of the corporate and some of the neoliberal, and I'm saying that in a very specific way, the notion that we can rely on markets instead of government to do some big things. That seems to be, like, in the works. Like, Joe Biden seems to feel like that's the case. Let's put aside the filibuster and the 50 vote issue right now. But the issues that we put into a basket of more sort of cultural, which is really in many respects more the Republican issue set, right? Those seem to be the ones that they're going to maybe, I don't know. What's the best way of putting this? They want to get their air balloon up in the air, and they're going to throw off some weight. And I get the sense that that's where things are starting to shape up. And I know that you have that perspective, at least on gun control. Give me your take on that. That thesis, if you will.
Right. I mean, setting aside the issue of the filibuster, and in fact, you kind of have to, because we only have it's a 50-50 Senate. It's not like that the Democrats have 60 votes. I mean, if they had, or even 58 votes or something, you know, where you could get rid of the filibuster and there'd be room for some of these more centrist types to move back and forth across the line. There's no room for anyone to do anything but stick with the party, or it's not happening, filibuster or not. I mean, the filibuster in that sense really is irrelevant for anything that Joe Manchin or Kyrsten Sinema, Mark Kelly, any of these people who are sort of perceived as being in the middle from purplish and purple states, that is where those issues come into play. I think the ones you're talking about, gun control, voting rights, you know, I don't know, something like Obamacare, if it were to come up, I think if the Supreme Court overrules Obamacare and the Congress has to move very quickly on Obamacare, you know, that's an issue where the Republicans will fight very hard. I don't know where Manchin would be on that. I assume he'd be on the right side, but you just don't know. So filibuster or not, you're dealing with those things. And guns is, you know, I mean, there is no greater fundraising, you know, apparatus than exists around guns, even without the NRA, which, you know, I noted in my piece this week, you know, we thought maybe with the explosion of Wayne LaPierre's NRA, he was, you know, ousted over corruption and self-dealing. And, you know, there's been a lot of scandal around the NRA, and they seem to have lost their clout. Other groups have come up, localized and maybe not so localized in the future, to kind of take their place. And they are even more extreme than the NRA. The pressure is going to be immense on, I mean, there's no Republicans. I mean, forget it. People keep saying that, well, after Newtown, we had 57 Republican votes and they're going to come up. I'm going, yeah, right. That was then, this is now, and they are not going to move. I mean, you think Donald Trump isn't going to sweep in if they try to do any kind of gun control and basically put a target, well, a figurative target on the backs of any Republicans who stray? So that is a 50-50 issue there. And that's when you have to start looking at Joe Manchin, and you have to look at him on voting rights. You have to look at him on immigration. Those are the issues where that's the heart of the Republican culture war. I mean, you've got Dr. Seuss and Mr. Potato Head and all that stuff for sure, but that is the heart. It's all about race and it's all about guns, and it's that and God. And God's not in play at the moment because abortion isn't on the table, but, you know, this is where they are. And and you've got to look at what Joe Manchin wants in those situations. And so what you're saying is absolutely true. What do we, you know, what do we throw out of the hot air balloon here? What are the things that are expendable in the short term, presumably, hopefully. I mean, we saw a little bit of that with the $15 minimum wage, right? I mean, that they had to appease Joe Manchin. You know, there were no Republicans involved. So this is, you know, we have to keep our eye on this. So it'll be very interesting to see, because I'm already seeing things about S1. Where they're talking about, you know, offloading a number of things in there, you know, that have to do with campaign finance. I think gerrymandering. I mean, I'm not sure, you know, the nonpartisan gerrymandering. I mean, there are a number of issues there that they seem to be thinking might be, you know, expendable.
Well, I you know, speaking to that, the one thing that I've seen floated. In you know, the gerrymandering would be, I think, devastating, because this is an opportunity for the federal government to actually to make sure that you don't have a situation where, you know, tens of millions of people vote for Democrats, but more Republicans get in, tens of million more people, and because of the gerrymandering. One of the things I've seen, you know, bandied about in that voting in S1 would be reenfranchisement of former felons. There is a lot of people who believe, because constitutionally, Congress does not have the ability. Congress has the ability to shape how elections, federal elections, happen explicitly. So things like gerrymandering, things about, like, you know, how you vote, how people, but it does not have the right to confer voting rights. It has the ability to sort of shape the context of the election, but not who is. So, like, things like voter ID, you couldn't necessarily get, you couldn't necessarily micromanage in that way. That may be susceptible as well to a Supreme Court challenge. They may look to things that are more likely to get struck down by the Supreme Court if those are things that Joe Manchin feels that he needs to go back and be the maverick and stuck it in the eyes of the Democrat. I mean, that's basically Joe Manchin's game. I think people should understand this is fundamentally different from, like, what we saw from a Joe Lieberman 15 years ago. Joe Lieberman, I think, had some real interests and ideological interests, and I think corporate interests in what he did. Joe Manchin, I think, has more of, like, a performative narrative branding issue. And it's a question of what can fulfill the Joe Manchin brand of not going along with Democrats on everything. And I think Sinema has a similar one, although she seems to have a problem in Arizona, because Joe Manchin has figured out how to win in a state that was heavily Donald Trump. Kristen Sinema, her poll numbers are falling because she's modeled herself after a Republican in John McCain. And it's one thing to be a maverick when you're a Republican in Arizona. It's another to try and do that when you're a Democrat, because the Republicans are just not interested in you. None of them are. And you need to basically just be enough of a Democrat, and she's losing Democratic support. So that's going to be helpful, I think, down the road. And that's what we lose side as progressives, as people of the left, as Democrats, whatever you want to say. The gain side, there has been reporting. Now we're starting to see, like, you know, Joe Manchin comes out and the thing he's saying, like, $4 trillion. He's saying go big, big, big on the infrastructure. We heard Joe Biden say $3 trillion the other day, but subsequent to that, we're starting to see all these reporting of, like, him meeting with historians and them almost being in a race to say who could say a bigger number and how quicker it should be and how non-bipartisan it should be. And supposedly we're hearing that Joe Biden is on board with this. And if Joe Manchin's on board with it and Joe Biden's on board with it, You've got the Joes, apparently.
Right. President Joes are on this. Yeah. I mean, I thought that was very, very interesting. I mean, you know, Biden, Biden is such an interesting character. I don't think we expected any of this from him necessarily. It makes you wonder, you know, there was a lot of talk about how he was too old and ancient and couldn't really handle the job. It makes me wonder if maybe the idea that, you know, you're closer to the end of your life, maybe you got a last chance to really do something, maybe that has actually spurred him into being more ambitious than he was when he was younger and concerned about his future. You know, I mean, this is the now for him, right? I don't know. I mean, that'll be up to the historians and psychologists to figure out. But it is interesting that he's doing that. And it's very, very interesting that he's doing it in a time in which the country, in which not the country is polarized, but the majority of the country seems to be on board with that aspect of his agenda. The infrastructure, the spending on COVID, the vaccination, you know, all that kind of stuff. They're with him, big majorities of independents, and they're liking him anymore, more. And there's a fair faction within the Republican Party that likes it too. So that's good. But what is different is that in Washington, obviously, it's as closely divided as you can get. I mean, the House is a very slim majority. The Senate is 50-50. For him to do this, in those circumstances is unusual, because even FDR had a big majority when he came in 1932, and certainly LBJ did in 1964. I mean, this is the kind of thing that you know, even an Obama. I mean, we just went through this, right, where he had, you know, we had 59 votes in the Senate, 60, and then, you know, we lost it and, you know, whatever. But this is going to be a very unusual thing. And what it says to me is an acceptance that we are in an unprecedented period in our political system. I think the country is probably less divided than the political system is, which is just to say that they realize for the first time, I think, that you're not going to be able to put that genie back in the bottle. This idea of bipartisanship, which in the entire post-war period was really what guided people, you know, that guided our legislation. Yes, you needed big majorities, which Lyndon Johnson had, and there was a lot of you know, pushback from the other side, but the parties weren't so ideologically polarized. So you had a chance that you could do some cross currents there, and, you know, sort of bring on board this bipartisan idea. It just doesn't exist. And, you know, they've got a gang of 20 or whatever they're talking about now, where they're all getting together and they want to save the filibuster and do all that stuff. I just don't believe it's possible. And it's not Donald Trump that's doing that. It's right wing media. It's social media. It is the radicalization of the Republican base. And that is going to carry on for a while. So Joe Biden has no choice. If he wants to do anything, they had to accept that. Finally, at long last, I mean, this has been going on for 25 years, but they finally reached a point where they went, look, you know, we're stuck here. There is nothing else that we can do other than try to enact our agenda. And hopefully people will understand that agenda is better for them and better for the country, and the country will do better and we'll be able to, you know, progress, which is the Democratic, you know, ideology, right? I mean, the Democrats are different than Republicans, which are basically trying to, you know, conserve the status quo or roll it back. They're not about progressing into some kind of a, you know, trying out new things or being experimental or doing things. So, you know, the fact that the Democrats under Joe Biden, of all people, seem to have accepted, I mean, you hear it from people like, you know, I don't know, Amy Klobuchar. She's not somebody I would expect to be, you know, radical on this stuff, but she is. So, you know, I think it's very interesting. I don't know if it'll work. I do not know. We're going to have to see. The next 2 years are going to be, next 18 months, really, are going to be fascinating. Because like I said, you still have you still have President Joe Manchin, but President Joe Manchin isn't President Joe Lieberman, which, as you say, you know, he is a different person. And we talked about this last week. The return of the earmarks is another thing. You've got a guy, you know, Joe Manchin, and you've got to look at the other side of him in West Virginia. He's got a governor there by the name of Jim Justice. Jim Justice was a, you know, Republican, then he was a Democrat, then he was a Republican. He's kind of a Joe Manchin kind of guy too, right? I mean, they're not doctrinaire right-wing talk radio kind of people, right? I mean, they're conservatives. And Justice, he was, bring me that COVID money. I want that relief money. Get it here and make more of it. There's a populist sort of thing that's going on there. And Justice wants that infrastructure, and he'd like to have some projects in West Virginia if he could. And I think he and Manchin are going to work for that. Those are the kind of dynamics that we're talking about that are just, you know, a little bit different than any, well, I shouldn't say a little bit, they're very different than anything we've seen in the last 25 or 30 years. As you say, the sort of death of the neoliberal, you know, dream that we could, you know, offload all these progressive goals onto the private sector and just help them out with a little money or, you know, some kludgy kind of deregulation or something. Well, it didn't work, clearly. So now they're doing this. And I think it's going to be very, very interesting. And I have very pessimistic feelings about those culture war issues. Immigration and guns. I think those are two that are going to be very, very tough, and very tough because of that Democratic faction in the middle. There's just a, you know, filibuster. If there is a filibuster, forget it. Now, nothing will happen on that. We will have forgotten it next week if there's no filibuster until the next mass murder, or you know, some other, the right wing gins up another crisis at the border. Voting rights are an existential issue for both parties. Right. I mean, you know, this is going to be fought.
And I don't think that the voting issues has the same sort of salience on the Republican side as it does. I mean, I have the certainly the politicians, but not necessarily the electorate. You know, like when I think about Joe Manchin, I don't think Joe Manchin is terribly concerned that his people are going to see him as a pro voting rights guy as much as he would be seen as like, because people forget Joe Manchin. When he ran for Senate, I remember that ad that he cut. It was against cap and trade. But let's be clear. He took the bill of the cap and trade and he shot it with an AR-15. That was his campaign ad. Well, listen, we just have a minute left. So I think this is, you know, this is going to be, I think, if I had to guess right now, and of course we don't because we'll be back next week. But if I had to guess about what the theme is going to be, I think it's going to be around this. I think we're going to see, and I think part of it is there's so many different factors here with just 30 seconds left. There's so many different factors here that are operating. Joe Biden might be that sort of Nixon to China type of situation, but we have this context where, you know, Sanders and the movement that he started 5 or 6 years ago has been building really since Occupy in many respects, Occupy Wall Street. And so there's this hunger for it. And I think when the Republicans were so inept in responding to $1.9 trillion, right? Like the administration, like we're going to do the $39.99 thing. We're not going to get accused of $2 trillion. But at $1.9 trillion, like not a peep from Republicans. I think that gave them some confidence. Heather, always a pleasure. We will be back next week to discuss it again.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Heather Parton is a weekly contributor to Ring of Fire Radio. You can find her writings over at Salon.com and, of course, the Uber blog, Hullabaloo. Now I turn the show over to Emma Vigeland. Emma, take it away.
Hi, everyone. I am here right now with Olufemi Taiwo, an assistant professor of philosophy at Georgetown University, and Abigail Higgins, a journalist who covers inequality, health, and gender. They wrote a piece in The Nation, How the Violence Against Women Act Failed Women. Thank you both so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So I'm really looking forward to talking to you about this piece because Joe Biden, obviously the president of the United States, now he heralds his Violence Against Women Act, which was passed in 1994 as a part of his much discussed and rightfully maligned crime bill. He talks about it with immense pride and as his prominent achievement as a senator. But what's not frequently discussed at all, which you both talk about with such insight in your piece in the Nation, is how the Violence Against Women Act in and of itself exacerbated mass incarceration, criminalization, not just the other elements of the crime bill. So can we talk about that broadly, and then we can focus on the more specific parts of the piece?
Sure. I mean, I think just maybe an important starting point, which I think just often isn't recognized, is that the Violence Against Women Act was part of the 1994 crime bill, right? Like, and it's often because it is discussed so differently and because it is utilized so differently by people like Joe Biden, it often sounds like they're two different things. And then even when you do realize that the Violence Against Women Act is part of the 1994 crime bill, it's often treated as an exception to the rule. You know, the reason that some sectors of the population have some consensus of it being an extremely damaging bill. It is treated as sort of like the one thing that perhaps made that bill worthwhile, when in fact history and present shows that they did a lot of the same things and had a lot of the same consequences, and you really can't extricate one from the other.
The other thing I would add is just, along with being part of the 94 crime bill, it was also part of a larger wave of welfare reform, which got culminated in the Welfare Reform Act of 1996 under the Clinton administration. And so beyond helping mass incarceration directly, there's the kind of indirect way that it forms a part of the larger politics in that period, which was taking resources away from social support and welfare and moving them into policing.
Yeah, so that was one of the most fascinating elements of what you guys wrote about, which I wasn't necessarily familiar with, was the historical context of the origins of the crime bill from the Cold War era, how there were left-wing movements that emerged, including the Women's Liberation Movement, and they needed funding, like any leftist movement really needs, and it's hard to come by. The right-wing movements, I work in left-wing media. Right-wing media, they get whatever they want. It's harder on our end. And it's the same with groups that are trying to make a difference. They started accepting government money, as you write, and that influenced a lot of the conversation around the Violence Against Women Act and the legislation that was passed. Can you give us some historical context surrounding that?
Yeah, so globally speaking, it was a pretty tumultuous time in world history. Before the Second World War, the British Empire alone controlled a quarter of the world's population and landmass. And there were something like 35 member nations of the United Nations. After the Second World War, there was a wave of anti-colonial movements concentrated in Asia and Africa. And this was happening against the backdrop of state competition between the United States and the Allies and the forces of capitalism and the Soviet Union and allied states who were supportive of communism. So there was the First World and the Second World and the so-called Third World, right? The non-aligned nations that were happening in this period. So beyond the kind of domestic ramifications of the new left that was emerging in opposition to the Vietnam War and in opposition to longstanding civil rights problems in the United States, was this concern that globally there was a chance to lose more. And so all these things helped fuel a heavy-handed government response to a lot of these new left movements in the 60s and 70s, which included things people call COINTELPRO, which is what they called the program. And it essentially just involved coordination between the FBI and police forces against the new left to sabotage and destroy those, but also to co-opt them. And I think the co-optation is what ended up implicating the women's liberation movement on this issue.
Yeah, and you know, I think you put it well in terms of it is always extremely difficult for left-wing movements to get the funding for what they want to do. And the new women's liberation movement was certainly subject to that. It was subject to funding constraints, and it was also subject to a lot of internal divisions. You know, which obviously hasn't changed in feminism and the women's movement. for decades. You know, you had a lot of divisions. You had class divisions. You had racial divisions, and you had a predominantly white parts of the feminist movement who really focused on building these shelters for women who wanted to get out of potentially abusive homes. A lot of that was super important work, and it was work that was really hard to fund. A lot of them had very radical origins that opposed the Vietnam War and didn't want to accept government funding because they knew about this government co-optation that Femi just discussed. But it's really hard because where else do you get money? And so some of these, you know, what were known as shelter feminists made some concessions to accept government money to the opposition of a lot of Black feminists who were working in the feminist movement at the time, who really recognized the state as its own kind of violent abuser. And that as soon as you accepted that kind of state money, you also accepted state control over a lot of your work.
Well, they were right. I mean, there's so many things here that just still exist today. One, and obviously the historical barrage of FBI interference of left into left-wing movements and murder and all of that. And then, of course, the schism between Black feminism or multicultural feminism and white feminism, which is the dominant part of our discourse way too often, and it usually serves upper class feminists in the professional sphere, but I don't want to get too far down that wormhole because I want to move a little bit further in history. You talk about in your piece George H.W. Bush's campaign and his use of the Willie Horton story. Can you expand upon that? Because as violence against women becomes more racialized in the discourse and also more prominent the issue, you see politicians like Bush one using a lot of this terminology, which becomes increasingly racialized, in order to buttress his campaign.
So Willie Horton was someone who was serving time for a previous offense, and if I recall correctly, was granted a furlough. And during that time, he committed a number of offenses, including the murder of two people and the rape of a white woman. And George H.W. Bush and his campaign cooked that into an ad and essentially said, you know, this is the future Democrats want, right? Little has changed in the intervening decades. Right? This is the kind of thing that they do. Trump made a very similar ad a few years ago in the run-up to the, I believe, the most recent election. And now in one sense, that's kind of par for the course because that is key Republican strategy. But a point that Donna Murch, who's a historian, that she made is that the response of Democrats is actually how we get the 94 crime bill. So a number of Democratic insiders, including now President Biden, including eventual President Clinton, and including other elites like Chuck Schumer, decided that they needed to run to the right on criminal justice reform to avoid the kind of devastating electoral results that Michael Dukakis got running against the Willie Horton ad that President Bush had put together. And so that went as far as President Bush flying, or sorry, President Clinton during the election for his first term, flying back to personally oversee an execution in order to craft this tough on crime message that the 94 crime bill was part and parcel of establishing for Democrats.
The execution of a Black man, and his name, the last name starts with an M. I'm blanking on it. I'm sorry.
Ricky Ray Ray.
An R. So it doesn't. Okay, never mind. But then, so yes, we're in the Clinton era now, and this is obviously when the crime bill and the Violence Against Women Act is birthed. And so it wasn't just the war on drugs element of the crime bill that ballooned mass incarceration. That's what is so key to your piece and what you lay out so well. So we're seeing the policing element of the rhetoric against violence against women expanding as those groups were getting government funding. It becomes more meshed together. And now in the Violence Against Women Act, there are funds, stop grants, money that is given to increase the arrest and prosecution of perpetrators of domestic violence, basically. So can you talk about what that did to advance a lot of the racial elements and the mass incarceration elements that are so under-discussed in this part of the crime bill?
Yeah, so the, you know, because of this atmosphere that Femi just described, the Violence Against Women Act was included in the crime bill in large part so that more progressive members of the Democratic Party would sign on to the crime bill. But because of all of those things that Femi was just describing in both parties, it was really crucial that these were still used lots of tough on crime language and included lots of tough on crime legislation. And so, you know, if you look at the debates that were occurring over the Violence Against Women Act, there was, you know, I mean, really like remarkable language that was like, you know, we need less money for social workers and more money for jail cells. And, you know, women are going to die if you don't vote for this bill. And, you know, we don't get more money in the hands of police and open up, you know, increase death penalties. It was like really remarkable language that was being used. And that language resulted in a lot of what are called mandatory arrest laws, which essentially means that when a police officer is called for a domestic violence incident or a domestic disturbance, then the cop has to make an arrest when they get to the residence. So, you know, I mean, obviously, there are a variety of like incredibly complicated situations that can occur when a cop is called. And if you are leaving one individual police officer to make a decision about who is going to get arrested, you know, even if both parties end up saying, you know, we don't want to make any arrests, like we don't want to involve the police, a police officer has to make an arrest. And one of the things that we saw from that is a dramatic increase of the arrest of women and a dramatic increase in the arrest of in the incarceration of women. We saw men's and women's incarceration increase significantly as a result of mandatory arrest laws. But like in California, the arrest of women increased by 400%. So
that was
really
an unreal statistic that you wrote. And then I'm sorry, just to cut you off really quickly, women recently in recent decades have been incarcerated. Their incarceration rates were increasing twice as fast as men, which is just something I was completely unaware of. Continue.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I think incarceration is still, it is still overwhelmingly men who are incarcerated. But yeah, women and Black women in particular are one of the fastest groups of incarcerated people in the United States. And these stop grants, which the Violence Against Women Act was full of, I mean, millions and millions of dollars. I think in 1995, there were $26 million for stop grants. And by 2010, there were $189 million for stop grants. And stop grants are basically almost exclusively money to increase either mandatory arrest or pro-arrest policies. So that is all money that is going to police departments and law enforcement to get people arrested and prosecuted and, you know, eventually incarcerated.
Yeah, the mandatory arrest element, I think, you almost take it for granted when you see, say, a domestic violence call in a TV show or something like that, that that's what happens. But it was not always that way. And as you guys write, it increases the adversarial relationship between the two parties involved, really, and involves the police in a way that, you know, with the Black community is more, rightly so, mistrustful of police, etc. So it's all these complicated dynamics. But it also occurs to me, too, just the when you talk about how this conversation became increasingly racialized in the discourse, how when you have lawmakers pounding the drum saying, you know, we have to protect women, we have to protect women. What that really meant was we have to protect white women. And a lot of this is about controlling white women. Lawmakers, white lawmakers, terrified about white women versus black men, etc. Was that a lot of the dynamic there, based on the Horton story that was discussed as well?
Yeah, and I mean, there was also the Minneapolis experiment, which a lot of this legislation was actually based off of, was an experiment in Minneapolis that was initially a relatively small study that basically showed that it kept women safer to make an arrest when a police officer came to after a call. And basically, massive publicity followed that study. You know, it was covered in the New York Times. It was covered in a bunch of different publications. And mandatory arrest policies increased dramatically after that study. And what was found out not that long after was that study was done in a predominantly white area. And it actually showed that mandatory arrest may help some middle and upper class white women. But the harms that it has for poor black people and for poor black women are remarkable, because it doesn't take into account the harms of incarceration on poor communities in the United States. And actually, the like later iterations of the study, and with like an expanded study pool, found that having a partner arrested increased black women's mortality by 98%. And that wasn't, wow. And that's, yeah, it's a crazy, crazy number. And that is not necessarily as a result of homicide. That's a result of things like heart disease and things like, you know, extraordinary levels of stress and diseases of poverty. And so I think that's something that I think we kept coming back to, is that this legislation just doesn't take into account how much poverty kills people. Yeah,
I would just add to that, you know, I think one of the things to question in the background of how we think about this politics is what the actual considerations were in terms of what's being protected and who's being protected. Because when a group of researchers, including one of the authors of the original study, did further study and found out that these effects actually backfire for significant amounts of people and that mandatory arrest wasn't helping, there wasn't any push from police departments to roll back these flawed policies. And a point that one of the Democratic supporters of the bill made at the time in 1994 is that a quarter of the money assigned to the crime bill was for the Violence Against Women Act. And that money went disproportionately to fund law enforcement and prosecutors, to fund trainings for them, essentially. But, you know, if you're following the accounting, if you're following the money, it was flowing from the coffers of the United States Congress into these institutions that have a vested interest in portraying crime in a particular way.
Yeah, it's just the increased militarization of police, and they have unlimited resources to basically behave in the way that we've seen a glaring spotlight on, especially in recent years. So let's bring it back to and end here, Joe Biden and his presidency, because he cites the violence. He just cited it in an interview with George Stephanopoulos on ABC as, you know, the crown jewel of his time in the Senate. Yeah, all the deregulation of the credit card industry, anyway, the crime bill itself, but the Violence Against Women Act he talks about with a lot of, I guess, pride. And he promised that in his first 100 days that they were going to reauthorize it. It lapsed in 2019, and it was just reauthorized in the House, but the Senate has to reauthorize it as well. It contains gun provisions, so Republicans are going to balk at that. But obviously, given this information that you've provided, I really don't want it to be reauthorized. So what is the path forward outside of the Violence Against Women Act? And what does this mean for Joe Biden and his kind of evolution on this front, if there is any evolution?
Great question.
It's pretty broad. It's pretty broad. But yeah, I like to try to stump people with the last question. Not really.
I mean, in many ways, it is the question, right? And for reasons that have to do both with, you know, the way that we think about violence and the actual kind of institutional problems of trying to address violence at its root, it's kind of the tough case for the increasingly mainstream conversation around prison abolitionism and police abolitionism and finding different more restoratively rooted ways and transformatively rooted ways to address crime and violence. And I would emphasize violence rather than crime because crime is politically constructed, blah, blah. But there are people doing a lot of work on more restorative approaches to addressing harm within communities. There's a peacemaking program that's being run by the Navajo Nation. Miriam Kaba's new book is best-selling, and people are beginning to think in more creative ways about other ways to address harm in communities other than policing, nightsticks, incarceration, and these more violent state-run methods. I think at a minimum, we have to reverse the kind of trajectory that got started in the 90s when they started defunding things that support people and routing that funding into police and adjacent institutions. And, you know, that is exactly the kind of intervention that people have been asking for. There was a recent study that we cite towards the end of the piece that talks about how the majority of people support something over 80% of victims of violent crime support alternatives to incarceration, and small minorities of them actually get support when they are harmed by other people from the system. So if we start shifting resources towards care and away from punishment, policing, and imprisonment, I think we'll be in a better position.
I think it's important to remember that there are some very, very complicated questions when it comes to addressing harm of any kind. But I think given the way that our society constructs these conversations, it's particularly complicated when it comes to sexual assault and sexual violence. And those questions are very hard to answer, and reparation of harm is very hard to figure out. But some things are not very hard to answer, and some things are very simple, which is that to decrease violence, people need stable housing. You know, people need economic security. People need to feel safe in their communities. And we know that disproportionately funding the police or funding the police at all does not increase safety in communities, does not reduce rape, does not reduce violence against women. And so I think if we're thinking about the Violence Against Women Act, and if we're thinking about what Joe Biden can do to decrease violence against women, as Aya Gruber, whose work we cite in this piece, says, give women money. You know, I mean, and that's what people need to be safe and to be able to live safe and peaceful lives.
Thanks so much. This was a wonderful interview, I think, and a wonderful piece in The Nation. Femi Taiwo, assistant professor of philosophy at Georgetown University, and Abigail Higgins, a journalist who covers inequality, health, and gender. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. Their piece is called How the Violence Against Women Act Failed Women.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for another week of Ring of Fire Radio. Hey, are you still subscribed to the free show? Head over to ROFpodcast.com. Support the show by becoming a member. Starting next week, we're going to be putting bonus material each week behind the paywall. New interviews from me each week. Don't forget, you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. And you can check out my daily show, The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm for my daily live stream covering all the biggest news stories of the day and also in-depth interviews. You can find Emma and I on the Peacock app as well. Check us out at 5 p.m. and 10 p.m. daily. For Emma Vigeland and Heather Parton, I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire.
Your entrance killed the laughter in the room. And my presence killed the laughter in you. The cue card got quit yesterday. You left without a thing to say. You kindly pass on through. That's how I see you. That's how I see you. That's the portrait I paint in my head every time I think of you.